Okay, good morning. Good morning. Good early afternoon. We're going to resume this conference on troop withdrawal. I'm Brian Ballow. I'm an associate professor in the Department of History here at the University of Virginia, and I'm also one of the co-chairs of Governing America in a Global Era program here at the Miller Center. And I'm delighted to moderate this panel today. The panel is Reasoning from Analogy, Using History to Get Out of War, a very timely topic. We have Jeffrey Record, who is going to talk about leaving Vietnam, insights for Iraq, and we have General Brower with us also to comment on Mr. Record's talk. Jeffrey Record is a professor in the Department of Strategy and International Security at the U.S. Air Force's War College in Montgomery, Alabama. He has firsthand experience in Vietnam, served as a pacification advisor in the Mekong Delta, and he has written extensively on the use of historical analogies, especially comparing explicitly Iraq and Vietnam. General Brower is the Deputy Superintendent for Academics and Dean of the Faculty at the Virginia Military Institute. He, too, served in Vietnam as a cavalry troop commander. He was an advisor for the Army to President Reagan during the Reagan administration. And among his many publications, he's author of World War II in Europe, The Final Year by St. Martin's Press. So I'm going to turn things over to Mr. Record. And General Brower will comment, and if all goes as planned, which it will because Mark Silverstone is running this conference, we'll have 20 minutes left for comments at the end.
Thank you very much. As an Air Force employee, I'm somewhat disoriented this morning since Secretary Gates chose to slaughter both the civilian and uniform leadership of the Air Force yesterday, and I expect there's going to be more to come. I may add that no one is more deserving of slaughter. I've been asked to comment on the whether or not the way in which we got out of Vietnam offers any insights into how we might get out of Iraq. And this is an area of a great deal of uncertainty. One of the things that you learn quickly when you try to compare Iraq and Vietnam is that the Vietnam War is a finished event, whereas Iraq is still ongoing, and we really don't have a clue as to how this thing is going to play out. My supposition is that America will eventually withdraw most or all of its military forces from Iraq. I can't tell you when. I can't tell you the circumstances under which it'll do that. And I can't tell you whether it'll be permanent. I mean, there may be some kind of residual force presence of some size left behind to perform some kind of function. I'm not clear on that. Obviously, the Vietnam War has figured quite prominently in discussions of the Iraq War, with critics using the Vietnam analogy to beat the Bush administration over the head. Both sides of the debate over the Iraq War have invoked historical analogies. The Bush administration has invoked the Munich analogy, obviously probably the most invoked analogy since the end of the Second World War, and still going quite strong despite the fact that you have a whole generation of policymakers now for whom Munich in the 1930s and World War II were something for the history books, have no really living memory of it. Obviously, the Bush administration invested quite a lot of energy in comparing Saddam Hussein to Hitler, which I think is quite unfair to Hitler. It was obviously Saddam Hussein, in terms of his recklessness and his brutality, was comparable to Hitler. But of course, he didn't have anything like Hitler's industrial power and military prowess. So he was a weak Hitler, if a Hitler at all. The Vietnam analogy may seem, I think, somewhat more relevant to Iraq. As in Vietnam, we seem to have stumbled into a bloody, protracted, and increasingly unpopular war against an elusive, irregular enemy. There's also the similarity of the U.S. security challenges in Iraq and Vietnam. We're trying to put together some kind of sustainable, politically sustainable, or encourage the formation of a politically sustainable government in Iraq, as we tried to do in Vietnam. We are trying to foster the creation of army and other security forces that are professionally competent and reliable in Iraq, as we did in Vietnam. Those challenges we failed in Vietnam. The jury's still out about whether or not we're going to be able to make this work in Iraq. There are some parallels between Iraq and Vietnam, but they should not obscure the really mighty differences between the two wars. The countries themselves could not be more different. Vietnam is an ancient and relatively homogeneous East Asian nation with a long lineage of powerful nationalism stretching back for almost two millennia. Certainly nationalism when it comes to hating foreign intrusion and influence. Iraq, in contrast, is a relatively recent creation. It was created out of the ashes of the Ottoman Empire, and it is, of course, distinguished by explosive ethno-sectarian divisions of the kind that you really don't find in Vietnam. Our objective in Vietnam was counter-revolutionary. It was to preserve the existing anti-communist order in the South. Our objective in Iraq, at least if you take the neocons, the more idealistic neocons at their word, is quite revolutionary. We're going to remake the political map of Iraq as well as the Middle East. In terms of the scale of the war, there really is no comparison. We deployed maximum troop strength in Vietnam is about 550,000. The communist forces, all told, mustered about 900,000. And if you throw in on our side, ARVN, which peaked at about 1,050,000. So just in terms of the sheer scale of the forces involved and the fighting involved, there's really no comparison. Our peak strength in Iraq is about 180,000 against enemy forces estimated anywhere from 20 to 50,000. We lost 58,000 dead in Iraq. We're at 4,000 plus 58,000 in Vietnam. We're about 4,000 plus in Iraq. The communists alone lost 1.1 million military dead in Iraq, not including the civilians, a staggering figure. If you want to get into that, I'll tell you how that breaks out historically. The loss rates are quite different. For 8 years of the Vietnam War, we lost 19 KIA per day of every week of every year of that war. So far in Iraq, we've been losing about 2 KIA per day. That's been fairly steady. It's been going down a little bit since the surge, although I'm not necessarily persuaded that surge is completely responsible for that. But again, I'm just trying to give you some gross numbers here to show you how different these two wars are in terms of the scale, forces involved in fighting, and so on. The insurgent organizations are quite different. This has been alluded to already. In Vietnam, we faced a highly disciplined, unitary, highly centralized enemy that had a specific political agenda. It had an order of battle that we were pretty clear on. It fielded forces, battalion-sized forces in the field. And it was a peasant-based organization. In Iraq, you have essentially an urban-based insurgency that is essentially a highly decentralized, loose coalition of maybe a dozen or two groups with various competing agendas. It's quite fair to say that somebody said yesterday that we're looking at five or six different kinds of wars in Iraq, whereas in Vietnam, there's really kind of one a central war. And it was also pointed out, I think, by Melvin Small, and that is we don't have anybody to negotiate with in Iraq. We knew the phone number of Hanoi. We knew who to go to in Hanoi if we wanted to settle this war. Who do we go to in Iraq? Which makes any kind of negotiated settlement much more problematic than it was in Vietnam. I would also point out that the Vietnam War engaged American society far more intensely than the Iraq War has. You know, the absence of conscription today has been pointed out. I don't think you can overestimate the impact of that difference between Vietnam, where you had a conscript army that was, for better or for worse, despite all the inequities of the draft system, was still pulling into its maw a relatively, compared to today, a relatively representative section of American society. You had a total of almost 3 million American troops who served in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War, over 2 million of them in Vietnam. over, of that 2 million, about 1,600,000 served in combat. In contrast, the number of U.S. military personnel who have been engaged in Iraq so far is about slightly less than 800,000. So the number of Americans who've been exposed to Iraq personally is far smaller than it ever was in Vietnam. Going back to Richard Nixon, I have to, you know, spend some time a little bit on Vietnam before I get into what we might be looking for in Iraq. My view is that, and I think the conference has borne this out, is that Richard Nixon may have had some idea that the war was militarily winnable, but that probably by the end of 1969, that idea had gone by the wayside. And from then on, and I think the tapes that were shown here reinforce the idea that from then on, at least Henry Kissinger, if not Richard Nixon, were viewing the war as an issue of damage control and how best can we get out with the least amount of damage. And they had at one point adopted some kind of a decent interval strategy where they wanted to make sure that some time elapsed between the time that the Americans got out and the time that Saigon inevitably fell. I find it very, very hard to believe that a cynic like Richard Nixon or a cynic like Henry Kissinger could actually believe that Arvin, whose performance had been a matter of record for years, was going to be able to accomplish what the American Army and Air Force could not accomplish after 8 years of trying. I mean, the idea that somehow Arvin would succeed where the Americans had failed simply staggers the imagination. So I have to assume that these guys did not believe that when they signed the Paris Peace Accord, they knew exactly what they were signing. Certainly President Chu knew what he was signing, as did the rest of the Arvin leadership. Nixon clearly pinned his hopes on Vietnamization, and you're looking at a total of 14 specific incremental withdrawals between 1969 and 1972. And I absolutely agree with those who were speaking yesterday. Mel Laird needs revisiting on this war. This man is a much, much more influential figure than he's been given credit for, regardless of what he's written recently. I mean, clearly this guy was the engine, and the idea that in an administration run by Nixon and Kissinger, that you could have an influential player like Mel Laird making announced troop withdrawals without bothering to check with the White House is great testimony to the political courage and the determination of this guy to get us out of Vietnam, because he saw this was a losing proposition from day one. Obviously, Vietnamization did not serve the objective of preserving an independent non-communist South Vietnam. I mean, 2 years after the Paris Peace Accord, and in this sense, the Nixon administration was lucky, because the decision of the North Vietnamese to launch the Easter Offensive of 1972, followed by the Linebacker II bombing in December, dealt very, very serious blows to the North Vietnamese military. It took them 2 years. The damage that they suffered as a result of those two bombing campaigns required at least two more years for them to reconstitute their forces to come back at South Vietnam in the spring of 1975. So in that sense, that the Linebacker 1 and Linebacker 2, which were much more savage than previous bombing campaigns had been, essentially damaged the North Vietnamese army to the extent that they could not even think about returning in force again for another 2 years, and that 2 years allowed Nixon and Kissinger and others to say, well, and Westmoreland, who said, you know, we didn't lose the war. South Vietnam was still a growing concern in 1973 when we got out. It was the South Vietnamese in Congress that lost it for us. The rest of my paper, the next section of my paper goes on to an extensive discussion of the decent interval strategy. My view is that this is what they had settled on. It's a very cynical view, but these were cynics that we were dealing with. Does how we got out of Vietnam, does this contain instruction for how we might get out of Iraq? Public and congressional pressures to get us out of Iraq, I think, are minuscule compared to the pressures that were upon the Nixon administration in 1969 through 73. I mean, let's face it, there isn't much of an anti-war movement here, in part because we're not engaged. The American society is simply not as engaged in this Iraq war as it was in Vietnam. I have students who are on their third and fourth tours in Iraq, and they do not understand why it is that nobody else really seems to care one way or the other. I can't explain it to them. When we decided to end conscription in 1973, this is the price that we paid. You're going to have a whole generation of American leaders who will have no personal military experience, and you will be able to fight a war, even a large war, although the all-volunteer force was not designed for this kind of war. It was designed for short Gulf War-type wars. But you were going to have an estrangement between the military arm of society and society as a whole. Now that Obama apparently has the nomination, John McCain obviously is committed. He said he wants to win. Not sure what that means. He's committed to retaining the additional 140,000 troops. We will be down next month. We will be down to 140,000. That will be the end of the surge. You cannot go back above the surge. So John McCain and George Bush are seeing eye to eye on this, that we, once the surge goes down back to 140,000, which it will in the middle of next month, that will be the benchmark operating force, at least for John McCain. There will be no further reductions, certainly for the remainder of Bush's administration. What happens after that remains to be seen. John McCain has said that he's committing to winning. You tell me what that means, and I'll tell you whether we're going to get there. Barack Obama has said that he wants to have American troops out within 16 months, although he's conditioned that on several, he and his spokesman have conditioned that on several occasions by saying that there might be a residual force presence if al-Qaeda is still active in Iraq. We might need a residual force presence to protect the oil facilities and the American embassy. Even from a logistical standpoint, even if the decision were made on January 20th next year that we're going to pull everybody out as fast as possible, you don't get the equipment out for at least 9 months. Given the port facilities and the port loadings and the amount of shipping that would be required, you simply cannot get out logistically within less than 9 months. Some people will argue a year. So my guess is that there's not going to be, my certainty is that it will not be an abrupt pullout, regardless of who's elected. Even if somebody was determined to do this, that you're probably looking at a period of 2 to 4 years before you have a substantial pullout. There is tension between the military leadership in Iraq, particularly Dave Petraeus and his acolytes, and the kind of the Washington Army back here in the United States. Secretary Gates, several months ago, indicated that he wanted to have force levels down to 100,000 by the end of this year. He has stopped talking about that. But clearly there's a tension between the Washington military establishment, which wants to, I think, accelerate withdrawals from Iraq, and the Army leadership in Iraq, which has a vested interest in conserving recent gains and in seeing this thing through. Maybe the first force reductions were already announced by Gates yesterday when he fired the Secretary of the Air Force. And I don't know. Anyway, and Bush has obviously said that he will and has gone along with whatever Petraeus wants to do. If we go into January of 2009, as we are apparently going to go in, with back to pre-surge levels with no below that cut, you're essentially handing Bush's predecessor a dilemma. And I think that this can be compared to Nixon. If the war goes south, you'll be able to blame Bush and company, will be able to blame, I left this war, we were winning the surge, the al-Qaeda had been on the run, the Sunni awakening in Anbar province, all this good stuff was happening, and then you guys came in and blew it. And in fact, I would argue that the decision to temporarily stand pat on the pre-surge troop levels was a deliberate decision, that it was a plan for exiting George Bush from the White House so that he can pass the war on to his successor without accepting responsibility for any failure. So here we have, I think, a clear parallel between, now I don't think Bush is, I think Bush is too naive to believe that this is a lost war. I think Nixon and Kissinger obviously at some point after late 1969 understood that this was a lost war and certainly wanted to do everything they could to make sure that the final denouement did not occur on their watch, that occurred on somebody else's watch and they could blame somebody else. And I think this is clearly what Bush will be able to claim historically, and that is that, you know, when I turn this war over, you know, we there had been a few years there of kind of fooling around and not making right decisions, and we weren't really on the top of our game. But, you know, there at the end, we'd really figured out how to win this thing. We had everybody on the run, and then now, you know, I turn it over. What do these guys do? You know, this Obama guy, you know, he doesn't know anything. He lost the war. Now, the question beyond this issue is that what is the end state? I mean, is there going to be a residual American force presence in Iraq? And that I think, depends. That's a question we cannot answer now. It depends upon events in Iraq. There is tension between, I think the Bush administration has indicated that they would like to have a permanent, an almost permanent U.S. force presence in Iraq. President Bush himself has talked about Korea. John McCain has talked about Korea, where we've had a force presence in Korea since mutual treaty in the early 50s. That would give us a degree of influence in Iraqi politics that we wouldn't otherwise have. On the other hand, the Iraqis have made it plain so far, those that have spoken up that are associated with the Maliki government, that they understand the need for maybe a prolonged American force presence, but they are not in favor of any kind of formal treaty that would essentially lock in an open-ended U.S. force presence. And the reason for that is obviously that such a presence would work against the legitimacy of the Iraqi government. The fact that we retain residual force presences in Japan and South Korea and Germany really is not relevant here, because these force presences are serving deterrence against other enemies. They're not involved with fighting inside the country. Let me close by saying that both Vietnam and Iraq underscore the American electorate's intolerance of protracted wars against enemies who fight in a manner that neutralizes the potential decisiveness of our conventional military superiority. Nixon observed that, quote, when a president sends American troops to a war, a hidden timer starts to run. He has a finite period of time to win the war before the people grow weary of it, end quote. In Vietnam, of course, Nixon sought not to win, but to get out without losing. What will the next president seek in Iraq? Thank you.
Good morning. You know, I'm a neighbor in the Shenandoah Valley of Charlottesville and the University of Virginia, and I've admired what the Miller Center has done with its program from over the mountain, and I'm very honored to be included in this particular program, and I'm grateful to Mark and his colleagues for the great job they've done putting this together. I do have sort of one complaint I'd like to share with Mark about the conference, though, and that's the terror of following Bob Salzinger as a commenter. You know, really sort of set the bar pretty high, Bob, and I'm a little bit nervous about this. The spring of 1972 provided me a strong personal appreciation of the politics of troop withdrawal, albeit one from a distinctly tactical perspective. My unit, F Troop 17th Cavalry, 196th Infantry Brigade, was based southeast of Da Nang at Camp Faulkner, and was at that point the last remaining American Armored Unit in Vietnam. On 30 March, the North Vietnamese Easter Offensive slammed into South Vietnamese positions in the I Corps tactical zone with conventional infantry and tank assaults backed by heavy artillery. It quickly overran South Vietnamese positions and seized the city of Quang Tri, and then moved south towards Hue, about 75 miles north of where we were. Another major coordinated attack struck in Tu Corps and threatened Con Tum, while a third plunged into the Three Corps tactical zone northeast of Saigon, capturing Lac Ninh and advancing towards An Lac. Now, when the offensive was launched, F Troop's 26 armored cavalry vehicles, 9 Sheridan armored reconnaissance airborne assault vehicles, 216 troopers, and its 26-year-old troop commander were poised to begin unit deactivation the next day. My platoons had been scheduled to enter the equipment turn-in sites and redeployment schedules for my troopers to return to the United States had been published. F Troop may have been the last remaining American armored unit in Vietnam, but its troopers were already psychologically on the way home. So the alert order that we received on 30 March to stand by to repel this invasion startled the troop, and if executed, it promised me an incredible leadership challenge. Within 72 hours, however, the clear realities of Vietnamization and 4 years of unilateral American troop withdrawals apparently became more evident to higher headquarters. The impending ground battle, they told us, was now totally to be an Arvin affair, and F Troop was ordered to deactivate. So here was a clear illustration on the forward edge of the battle area of how troop withdrawal policies indeed reduce military capabilities. So it was at the butt end of a bad war. In his fine paper, Jeffrey Record explores other less obvious insights that might be gleaned from the American military withdrawal from Vietnam and then used to advantage our understanding of the contemporary challenges the United States faces as it seeks to extricate itself from Iraq. An accomplished and careful historian, Record recognizes, like Henry Kissinger, that history teaches by analogy, not maxim, and that the value of an analogy depends crucially upon our understanding of its limits. Nonetheless, that others have taken less care in this regard is clear from the historical record. Indeed, the use and misuse of analogies in history by presidents and policymakers remains a thriving cottage industry. Richard Neustadt has gone so far as to observe that most policymakers use analogies for two purposes: to persuade others, or for personal comfort, or as he colorfully puts it, as battering rams or Linus blankets. Not so in this paper, as Record stresses that the differences between Vietnam and Iraq greatly outnumber the similarities, and he's accounted to this to you recently, obviously, in scale, objectives, the natures of the societies involved, and importantly, the nature of the insurgency. Perhaps most important, he reminds us that in the Iraqi case, the United States faces a disparate, non-unitary enemy, which, unlike the communist government in Hanoi, offers no single adversary with which to negotiate the politics of withdrawal. However, he also notes that both the Iraq and Vietnam cases shed common light upon significant concerns that American policymakers have about the dangers of protracted war and on the traditional appreciation Americans have for the relationship between such domestic pressures and national policy and strategy. Following World War II, George C. Marshall succinctly captured this concept when he reminded his biography that, quote, a democracy cannot fight a 7 years war. The British military theorist and historian B.H. Liddell Hart elaborated further by advancing the thesis that democratic strategists work on, quote, a narrower margin of time and effort and cost than their non-democratic counterparts. Now, these concepts place great pressure on Americans to develop strategies which deliver what I call incremental dividends in order to sustain popular support. And by this, I mean unless clear incremental evidence of progress towards the strategic aim is demonstrated, the strategy and its political aim risk rejection as the blood and treasure is withdrawn. In his paper, Professor Record carefully describes a period in which the world's most powerful nation was slowly, painfully, reluctantly coming to grips with the limits of its power. He notes that Nixon and Kissinger viewed Vietnam as a strategic impediment to their detente and normalization strategies with the Soviet Union and China. These were essential elements of their so-called grand design. And he also notes that Nixon believed that the war was no longer winnable in the traditional sense. But both Nixon and Kissinger appreciated the significant psychological component in international power relationships. To them, credibility was an essential component of great power performance. And indeed, determining how the United States could extract itself credibly from a Vietnam War that they both viewed as increasingly peripheral to American interests would preoccupy them for the next 4 years. The one thing we've seen from the conference and from our study of this is we know this to be certain. They firmly believed that an abrupt withdrawal would undermine the ability of the nation to play the central role that they envisioned in their grand design. This is a familiar quote, but I think a powerful one. This is Kissinger. "We could not simply walk away from an enterprise involving two administrations, five allied countries, and 31,000 dead, as if we were simply switching a television channel. It was important for America not to be humiliated, not to be shattered." So peace with honor became the administration's shorthand for their aim of being able to withdraw from Vietnam without having been forced to do so. Portraying this withdrawal as an act of policy and not collapse would, in their view, allow the United States to play its keystone role in the international structure of peace that they sought to construct. Jeff clearly demonstrates that the Nixon-Kissinger strategy for attaining this ambitious aim was multifaceted, creative, cynical, and ultimately unsuccessful. Their basic strategy sought a negotiated settlement while applying diplomatic, military, and psychological pressure on Hanoi and simultaneously strengthening the defensive capabilities of the South Vietnamese. Vietnamization would strengthen South Vietnam through huge transformations of military and economic aid, the training and equipment of a larger South Vietnamese army, and the transferring of the responsibility for the conduct of combat operations to Saigon, with an attendant reduction of the American combat role and naturally of American casualties. Detente and normalization were designed to isolate Hanoi from its Soviet and Chinese support by persuading Moscow and Beijing that the alluring benefits of the grand design outweighed the pleasure of sustaining an American quagmire in Southeast Asia. Cross-border operations into Laos and Cambodia were to be spoiling attacks to buy time for Vietnamization to take root, and they would also demonstrate to Hanoi the administration's willingness to raise the stakes to exercise courses of actions that previous administrations had ruled out. Nixon's secret menu bombings of Cambodia in 1969 and 70, his incursions into Cambodia and Laos in 1970 and 71, the mining of Haiphong and the B-52 bombings of Hanoi in 1972, were calculated signals to Hanoi that it was now dealing with an unrestrained and perhaps unstable American leader. Here was the seed of the so-called madman theory attributed to Nixon, the belief that an adversary would be more willing to reach agreement or back away if he was not so sure how his opponent might react. We've seen that such strategies naturally fueled strident anti-war protests in America. And despite their tough talk, Nixon and Kissinger were not unaware that their strategy would be threatened by such unrest. In this context, Nixon's aggressive plan for the phased withdrawal of American forces, carefully coordinated with administration initiatives, was an effort to make a virtue out of necessity by timing designed to take the wind from the anti-war sails. Consider, for example, the timing of Nixon's announcement 10 days before the 1970 invasion of Cambodia that 150,000 American troops would be withdrawn before the following spring. "The time has come," he privately told his aides, to drop a bombshell on the gathering spring storm of anti-war protest. This glimpse of Nixon's rationale and his sense of importance of timing reveal the pre-planned nature of the troop withdrawal strategy, its place in the administration's overall Vietnam strategy, and its aims. As record notes, troop withdrawals and Vietnamizations also combined to dramatically reduce American casualties. When coupled with the administration's termination of the Selective Service Draft calls, the student protest heart of the anti-war movement was greatly weakened. Even acerbic Kissinger critic Roger Morris grudgingly acknowledges that, quote, domestic dissent faded steadily with the American troop withdrawals. No matter how elegantly conceived their Vietnam strategy may have been, no matter how well they coordinated the various instruments of national power, John Gaddis reminds us that Nixon and Kissinger were like short money players in a high-stakes poker game. Phased troop withdrawals weakened the American hand significantly and provided little incentive for Hanoi to concede on outstanding political issues. As a result, as record demonstrates, American concessions followed in the 1973 version of Peace with Honor differed significantly from the version that was envisioned in 1969, most significantly in the abandonment of the mutual troop withdrawal provision. Now, just as an aside, we've talked a lot about the decent interval strategy, and I've confessed I've been struggling and wrestling with this now for a number of years. I'm pretty persuaded, as most here seem to be, that Kissinger is a decent intervalist by almost any measure. Exactly when he becomes a decent intervalist depends on how cynical you are about it, I suppose. But surely after the failure of the Laotian incursion in 1971, in early 1971, it's clear that he's a decent intervalist. Until really this conference, I haven't been so sure about Kissinger as a decent intervalist. He has a way of persuading me, as I read the materials, that he really intended to try to enforce the treaty. But I'm sorry, I meant Nixon. I meant Nixon the second time. I'm sorry about Nixon. What I meant was, I'm not so sure about Nixon. He has a way, as I read the documents, of persuading me that he really intended to enforce the treaty. I'm sorry for that. I remember there was a book by Mark Clodfelder about air power and termination of the Vietnam War. I know that Jeff's real familiar with it. And there's a chapter in there about the Christmas bombings in which it's entitled "In Persuading Enemy and Ally." And he argues that the Christmas bombing was to persuade Tu to sign the treaty, but it was also to do so by showing Tu what he would do to Hanoi if they violated the treaty. Now, for a long time, that's been a powerful thing for me, but after Ken Hughes started to show me the documentary evidence in real time, I think I've come around to Jeff's conclusion that the United States cut its losses in this war, in an unpopular war, that it could not win at any acceptable price, even though they recognized, Nixon and Kissinger, that withdrawal meant the near certain loss of South Vietnam. So at that point, it seems to me the question is, how do you go about analyzing this differently? And I say, Kissinger tells us that it's a good practice to judge leaders and nations not only by their actions, but also by their conception of alternatives. And so let's take a look at the alternatives that they consider. No one would really truly suggest that that they did not face new and complex international challenges in 1969. And just the whole notion of extracting oneself from Vietnam, the whole notion of strategic parity with the Soviet Union, the expanded influence of Europe and Japan, all of this trying to adapt to the appreciation for the limits of American power. Bob Jervis has argued in his earlier paper that Nixon's slow withdrawal policy brought him first a degree of strategic flexibility and some retention of the initiative. Secondly, at least one important political concession from Hanoi, and third, the time for substantial change in the international environment that would allow not only a decent interval, but also some attenuation of the consequences of American defeat. And that was a sparkling discussion that followed with regard to that, and perhaps these alternatives were the best that could be rescued from the circumstances that Nixon and Kissinger inherited. And perhaps Nixon's strategy of lingering was prerequisite for securing a decent interval between withdrawal and North Vietnamese victory, and justified the enormous price that the next 4 years would entail. And perhaps a negotiated settlement in 1969 that traded an American withdrawal for the return of American prisoners of war and saved 21,000 American soldiers' lives and countless Vietnamese strategies casualties would not have been the calamitous threat to international equilibrium and American national security that they so darkly predicted. These are difficult questions. They're the heart of the matter. But I think they're going to ultimately be questions that remain elusive to historians. History is lived forwards, but is written in retrospect, C.V. Wedgwood reminds us. We know the end before we consider the beginning, and we can never wholly recapture what it was to know just the beginning. Professor Record is therefore also appropriately cautious when it comes to offering insights from the politics of troop withdrawal for our contemporary challenges in Iraq. My sense is that he's heavily influenced, as I am, by the great American philosopher King Rogibera, who warns us that it's tough making predictions, especially about the future. Record assumes that there will be a substantial drawdown, with the pace to be influenced substantially by the results of the election, by evidence or the lack thereof of a reduction in sectarian and ethnic violence, and by evidence or the lack thereof of an enhanced effective indigenous governance. In his view, he might have changed just a little in his oral commentary, but I think the way I read it, he believes that the withdrawal will be a complete withdrawal without a residual American presence. I agree with that conclusion. In Iraq, regrettably but unsurprisingly, it seems to me, our forces and representatives have, in large degree, assumed the roles of occupiers and outsiders. And in the final analysis, these decisions, which are going to be decisive, these responsibilities have to rest with the host country and its security forces, not with the Americans. As in the case of the Nixon administration, the Bush administration should be judged not just by its actions, but also its conception of the alternatives it now faces in the lee of its surge strategy. The administration has signaled clearly that it will seek to exploit the security gains it sees linked to its surge strategy, gains which they also argue have helped to clear the way for political and economic developments. And that they believe that the administration has made it clear that they will stabilize force levels probably at or near the pre-surge 140,000 level, at least until the inauguration. They also get to the question of cost. The administration acknowledges that the cost is heavy financially, but they argue also that these are relatively modest costs if you compare them to, the Cold War. They kind of disarmingly use the defense budget as their indicator, and they point out it is 4% of the American economy, and that's lower than at any point during the 40 years of the Cold War. And then the president goes on to argue that this modest fraction of America's wealth actually pales when one considers what the cost would be of another terrorist attack on the country. The administration has been strong in its argument and echoed some, I think, mostly by the McCain administration, by the McCain camp, that we have a moral responsibility to avoid a premature withdrawal as a civil war would very easily descend into genocide, destabilizing the entire region and endangering vital national security interests. The president just last month, in that speech on the 10th of April, pointed out that if the United States falls in Iraq, al-Qaeda would claim a propaganda victory of colossal proportion. They could gain safe havens in Iraq from which to attack the United States, or our friends and allies. He went on to say that Iran would fill that vacuum, and our failure would embolden its radical leaders and fuel their ambitions to dominate the region. And he pointed out that it would also give confidence and greater boldness to the Taliban in Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda in Iraq and in Pakistan. And then there's a little bit of a reference to Vietnam, in which he says other violent extremists around the world would draw the same dangerous lessons that they did from our retreats in Somalia and in Vietnam. So he's again trying to rely on that analogy. I'm getting the hook here. Let me just quickly say, the president.
You definitely outrank me, General. Oh. So.
I will try very quickly to end this. The president then goes on to say what the consequences of victory would be and why that would be so significant. And when you look at this from the question of sort of considering alternatives, it turns out that it's not much of an argument, much of a reflective argument for strategic creativity by the administration. Now, but is there a case for strategic patience? And that's the point I want to finish with. Anthony Quartzman has recently offered what he freely admits is a tenuous case for strategic patience. And it's sort of a beguiling mixture of what you would call a pottery barn, if you break it, you buy it kind of philosophy, moral and ethical guilt, and really some hard-boiled realism on his part. And he's essentially targeting the next administration. He's trying to influence the next administration's thinking on this. And he's trying to build upon what he sees as the successes that came out of the surge strategy. But the point is, he thinks they're sort of lucky successes. They're not really, there was a sort of confluence of what we were doing in the counterinsurgency war and the Sunni awakening. He also thinks that we've got the best country team on the field that we've had. He calls it the A team. That we have on the field. And he thinks that moderate Shiite leaders are becoming equally concerned about the Sadr militia, and so that there's some opportunities for success here. But when you ask him, well, how much opportunity for success, he says he can't really say. Maybe a little bit better than even if, and then he gives us three things. You know, if Iraqi's political leaders do move forward in 2008, if the Sunnis are co-opted by the government and brought into Iraqi security forces, and if the U.S. does not rush out for domestic political purposes. It reminds me of the, we could have some ham and eggs if we had some ham, and we had some eggs. So accepting such a risky strategy would react to events rather than to shape them in a climate when the odds of success are less than even reflects Quartzman's pessimism about the fact that there are no good options. He says we have to take the least bad option. But what he does say, which kind of resonates with me, is that, you know, everybody recognizes we made a mistake going in there and that we bear some responsibility for all of the damage we've done. And what we can do is to make some judgments, affect some judgments on how we leave and what we've done to ameliorate that damage. And he thinks the United States will be judged far more by how it leaves Iraq and what it leaves behind than how it entered. Everyone's familiar with the challenge to the president's modest, relatively low-cost thesis and the $3 trillion argument, which it seems to me very powerful. And given this, I mean, given an ambiguous and uncertain outcome, an ill-defined timetable for success, an increased sense of the perils of American overstretch and vulnerability, broadening international and domestic revulsions, and the increased strain on the international and domestic economy of a war that costs $12.5 billion a month for Iraq alone, I don't think it's too bold to conclude that the next administration, whoever it is, will face a virtually irresistible pressures to promptly create the conditions for its own decent interval strategy. But the thing that I think is different about this is what Jeff said. I even think it takes longer than 9 to 12 months. It probably takes 18 months or more to just get out of Iraq. And the question is, how can you use that time to create a decent interval strategy where the decency here is that we're trying to make some ameliorative efforts to fix what we've broken. You know, and that'll be the test, it seems to me, of this. Thank you very much.
Okay, we're open to your questions. And just remind us who you are, even though most of you know each other.
Yeah, Chester Patch, Ohio University. This is for Jeffrey Record. And it's really inspired by the gross numbers you gave us, the differences in Vietnam, 550,000 when troops withdrawals began, presumably 140,000 when the next president takes office. Nixon always said that the withdrawals were contingent on either progress in Vietnamization, reduction in the level of enemy violence, progress in negotiations. It turns out they were always key to Vietnamization, at least in his public announcements. But it was a phased withdrawal, and I think you mentioned there was a kind of fork in the road when they got down to 280,000-odd. They had to, once they reached that level, then there was some hard thinking to do. So my question is, given that there will be about 140,000 Americans in Iraq, does a phased withdrawal make any sense? In other words, conditioned on something like reduction in the level of violence or progress in Iraqi forces, or will the withdrawal have to be a kind of all or nothing thing? It's something, and that's we're pulling all American troops out. It will take a while to do that. They'll have to come out in increments. But does a phased withdrawal make sense? If so, what would given the way American forces are constituted and their numbers, what would a troop increment be like? And would there be a sort of comparable fork in the road beyond which, if you get to a certain level, going below that level might endanger in some way the American forces who are there?
I think, you know, the best way to measure increments is brigades, because that's how the administration been counting, you know, 15 versus 20 brigades. You started at 15, you surged to 20, you're pulling those fire brigades out. Again, you know, Nixon set those conditions, and then, you know, events overtook the administration. I mean, like salted peanuts, and with Mel Laird in the driver's seat, essentially, they were withdrawing at a pace that far exceeded any progress in negotiations. And we don't have any negotiations going on in Iraq, because we don't have anybody to negotiate with. I think given what Casey said, and I'll defer to his judgment, if we're talking, you know, 12 to 18 months, from simply a logistical standpoint, to move the stuff out of Iraq, then we do have a window here. And you know, neither Hillary Clinton nor Barack Obama took the George McGovern position that the minute I'm elected, I'm pulling everybody out of Iraq, Vietnam. They haven't really said that. There has been a diminution of violence. I think that has been for a number of reasons. I think the surge can take some credit for that. I think ethnic cleansing had kind of played out. You know, at some point, ethnic cleansing is over, and I think the ethnic cleansing in Baghdad had pretty much played out. But I think that the great stroke of good fortune for us, and one in which we, Petraeus and others, took advantage of, was the Al-Qaeda alienation of the Sunni tribal sheikhs in Anbar and elsewhere, forcing these guys to turn against them. And of course, we were there. We understood what was going on. So I think it's very hard to get your hands around who the enemy is here and what level of violence you think is satisfactory. But I think that, you know, that over the next, if we're looking at a minimum of 18 months in which we can contemplate significant troop withdrawals on a brigade basis, you might well be able to get down to maybe half the current level, barring some major event that's unforeseeable. You know, we're not talking about a Tet offensive here. We're not dealing with an enemy that can launch the functional equivalent of a Tet offensive. They just simply don't have the numbers. Whereas the Viet Cong did. So, I mean, I think that by the end of 2009, barring some horrendously unexpected event, you ought to be able to look at maybe half of what we have there now. But again, this war has not engaged American society the way that Vietnam did, and I don't think you're going to see any great increase in pressures. If anything, the pressures are going to be driven by fiscal rather than blood sacrifice I hate to say that, but that's where I think the pressures are going to be. And the sense among the ground services, particularly the Army, that we can't, you know, the Army simply cannot sustain this much longer.
Bob Jervis. First, one very brief comment on Iraq, and then a question of both Iraq and Vietnam. The comment is, I think we tend to underestimate the degree to which the violence in Iraq is fueled by criminality, competition for money. My friends and former students who've out there say that especially the turning away of the Sunnis from Al-Qaeda is less that Al-Qaeda's been brutal and less that they've been religiously fanatic and more competition over smuggling routes. You know, I have no direct evidence. It fits with, you know, what I think is a pretty coherent and plausible view of the world. And I think in many areas, not that the sectarianism and anti-Americanism are absent, but I think the power struggle, which is in really just intimately fused with competition for resources, for money, is very important. And it makes the thing underlying what Philip Zelikow said at lunch, makes it, you know, multiple wars, multiple places. My question, both Vietnam on the counterfactual and Iraq, is on residual forces. And I was influenced on Vietnam by Stephen Randolph's book on the Easter Offensive, which I thought was very interesting and did both what's happening on the ground and then all the capitals. And he argues that what would be familiar to military people, but less to someone like me, is that what was crucial was the coordination involved in American air power, that we had to have people on the ground, not to do the fighting, but to call in the airstrikes, and that was not something the South Vietnamese really could do. You know, they hadn't had training, they didn't have the equipment. And it leads to the question of whether Nixon could have done effective bombing in the South with all the Americans out, unless you had people on the ground to really work the airstrikes. Would the idea of punishment, or at least local interdiction of work, punishing of the North could work, but would the same thing that had worked in the Easter Offensive have worked? And that might be something that, you know, you people have more experienced military could comment on. On the decent interval, I think we're asking a question that can't be answered. My sense, not as much people who've listened to the tapes, is Nixon doesn't know. He doesn't have to know to withdraw. All he has to know is that he has to withdraw. And maybe he's going to get a decent interval. I mean, he's pretty sure he's going to get it. Maybe he's going to get something better. With that, he doesn't have to decide what he's going to do. Then when the North Vietnamese break the agreement, as he's sure they will, he'll decide then. Now, turns out, by that time, Watergate is broken, the situation has changed. But I, in some sense, think the question of did he think there would be only a decent interval is a question that's unanswerable, because Nixon, you know, if we were alive and gave him truth serum, or we had him at the time and asked him, he would say, I don't give a shit. That's not a question I need to answer to do my job. So I think in a way here's where our being academics hurts us. I think we're asking for a degree of consistency and looking ahead that there's no reason for him to do. And then, on the residual force, final point, on in Iraq, my question for both of you is whether this idea of a strategic overwatch, what does it mean? Does it make any sense? Again, the military people I've corresponded to in Iraq actually are quite skeptical. But as you know, Hillary Clinton talked about it. There's quite a bit of talk about that. And I wonder, leaving aside domestic pressures that might preclude it, what you think of that.
Sorry? Okay, I'll talk first about the Easter Offensive and your point about the coordination of the air power, which was decisive. You know, the curious thing about the Easter Offensive is that about the only military choice that Hanoi could have made, that we had some effort, some ability to really hurt them if they did that, was to conduct a conventional attack. We weren't very good at finding them in a lot of places, but when they're driving tanks down Route 1, we know how to shoot those guys, you know, and so they played right to our strength. And I think another question then is, so what is that, you know, what in the world are they thinking about, and what's the thing that's pushing them to make those decisions? So then the question is, now we're gone and we don't have these kinds of liaison teams in the theater of operation, and there's another 1975 invasion. How could we have hurt them? Well, I don't think we hurt them very well in the tactical fight, which is what you're talking about. But we do help. We can hurt them in the operational fight and in the strategic fight, and we can go to Hanoi. We can go back downtown with the B-52s, and you can interdict, you can sort of isolate the battlefield. So I think it's what's different is the ability to affect the tactical fight, you know, and then the question is, you know, so now you got all your POWs back and you're out, and when you do that, you're going to get some more POWs, and so you know, how does that mix work into this? You know, I want to really punish these guys for violating this agreement, you know, and that's why I've wrestled with it forever, because I will say that there is a tendency among us to not give Nixon much benefit of the doubt. We see the dark side and we want to see it every time. And so the letters to Tew, he's lying, you know. When he tells him he's going to do this, he's lying, you know. Well, I don't know. I mean, he deludes himself a lot, and I think he might have intended to enforce that treaty. That's where I am.
I want to say that I disagree with the notion that Nixon was a man without values. I think he worshipped hatred more than anything else. You talk about a residual U.S. force present. I think you can envision a situation where we sign some kind of treaty with Iraq, in which best case scenario would be that we have no combat forces stationed inside Iraq, we don't have any air bases, we don't have any naval bases. What we do have is an advisory military presence, which could include a number of forward air controllers. And then your overwatch would be from Kuwait, where we have substantial military installations. And if necessary, you could put carriers inside the Persian Gulf, although the Navy is very reluctant to do that, but you can still operate. There are, given the increasing range of American air power, and particularly standoff capabilities, you could provide substantial air support to engaged Iraqi ground forces. It wouldn't be the same as having American ground forces, but I think the trade-off there would be that, and I think this is the main concern of the Iraqi government, that any kind of permanent, certainly highly visible force presence essentially chips away at whatever legitimacy, as it did in Vietnam. I mean, the government of South Vietnam never really commanded the kind of legitimacy simply because it was seen as simply a Cold War creation of the United States, which was basically what it was.
We have time for one more short question from Bob.
Yeah, Bob. Hi, Bob Schulzinger. I wonder if the two military men could comment on what the likely attitude of the professional and volunteer military is going to be after the Iraq War toward, specifically toward the civilian leadership, and then reflecting on our last session on United States society. You know, the common view is that from 1975 to well into the 90s, the professional officer corps felt a very strong sense of betrayal, or at least alienation, from the civilian leadership during Vietnam, and certainly in the 1990s was suspicious of and hostile to the civilian leadership in the Clinton administration. What's going to be the likely outcome of the Iraq War in that regard?
Last year I wrote a piece in the Strategic Studies Quarterly called Back to the Weinberger Powell Syndrome, in which I argued that the military's reaction, particularly the Army's reaction, is going to be likely a re-embrace, if not the specific tenets of the Weinberger-Powell doctrine, then the functional equivalent thereof. They're going to be, they'll be wanting to adopt a much more restrictive use of force doctrine, even though the adoption of that doctrine didn't tie any president in any way, shape, or fashion. But I think that the Army will respond to this as never again. We don't ever want to repeat this story again. We've seen this movie twice now in Vietnam and Iraq. We don't want to be treated to a third version of it.
I do think that the first thing I would say is I would not attempt to generalize about the officer corps, because I think the officer corps is got a lot of variety and nuance to it, and I think it's an extremely reflective, sort of self-reflective kind of organization, frankly, and I'm very proud of the officers and soldiers who have done that. But I think we're probably in many ways our hardest critics, and we always are trying to see how we could do these things better. And we know that this is not just something that was screwed up by the civilian leadership. We know that there have been people that we admire who made bad decisions, military officers of significant stature and good and decent men who made really some bad decisions. So I wouldn't generalize about it. I think there are a lot of officers who will try very hard to learn from all of this and are trying and doing a lot of different and very creative things in different parts of Iraq in a war which is a mosaic war in a remarkable sense. There are multiple wars going on, and you got captains and majors and lieutenant colonels who are doing very creative things trying to deal with that war. But that's just the counterinsurgency part of it. There's a whole other part to this thing that we're not doing extremely well at all. The American government. I would say though that I think it's fair to say we feel as if we've been used. I mean, we're the ones going back on third and fourth tours, and we're the ones whose families are suffering, and we're the ones who we're not doing a very good job of taking care of the maimed soldiers that are coming back from this, and that's just the bow wave of a whole problem that's going to affect us for a long, long time, and we've gone willingly, and we've gone to try to get the job done that we were told to do. And I think we don't feel like many people are very interested in what we've been trying to do. And I think there's a chance that there's going to be, if not a divorce, a separation for a while, because we feel like we've been used.
Well, I know that there are many more questions out there, and I'm sure that our panelists will agree to exercise a staged withdrawal from the dais rather than a unilateral one. I want to thank them very much.